You are listening to the Cycling Podcast and the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour.
The home of cycling with character.
Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run. Stage 6. Today we are in Ares del Maestrat.
So, as anticipated, that was an incredibly difficult start to the stage today.
Fortunately, I think it's one of those days where the TV just won't do it justice.
Wow, we indeed. That was our Vuelta a España diarist, Nick Schultz and James Knox, summarising very briefly the events of Stage 6 of the Vuelta a España. We'll hear a lot more from them later on in the podcast in Part 2. But Daniel, it was a hectic old day on the Vuelta, but here we are, a little oasis of calm. Running water I can hear trickling away over there. The heat is sort of finally fading out of the day. This kind of place is typical Grand Tour accommodation for you, isn't it, Daniel?
Well, that sounds loaded. That sounds like a barbed comment. What do you mean?
I mean, we're a good kilometre and a half from civilisation.
Yeah, kilometre and a half. How are you going to survive without your 5G, you know, mobile service?
But it was a really hectic day on the Vuelta. A lot happened, so let's summarise that in the tale of the etapa first of all. It was stage 7 from Mora de Rubielos to Ares del Maestrat. Is that correct, Daniel?
Ares del Maestrat. But we're in the territory. Well, this often happens in Spain, doesn't it? That you there are multiple names, or you get like a Spanish name. I saw what definitely looked like a Spanish name for the finish town and a different name on the road, but which I presume was in a Valencian name.
We've come out of Aragon back into Valencia, right?
Correct.
The stage was 200 kilometres long, just about, really long by Vuelta standards, that. And as I say, an extremely eventful day. The headlines are that Jesús Herrada succeeded where his brother and Cofidis teammate José fell short yesterday. We have a new wearer of the red jersey, and a big crash has taken out several big names. There was a really hard start. It took the best part of 50 kilometres for the break of 11 to get clear. The crash that took out red jersey holder until yesterday evening, Nicholas Roach, and EF Education First Rigoberto Urán and Hugh Carthy, happened around halfway through the stage. Urán and Carthy abandoned immediately, as did CCC's Victor de la Parte. Roach did get back on his bike, but he had to stop a few kilometres later, so that was a real bad crash, and some hefty casualties of that crash. By that stage, the break had a healthy lead as they reached the penultimate climb of 25 kilometres to go. Skubbu Grumme attacked and went over the top of the climb alone. He rides for Mitchelton Scott, of course. At this point, Ineos's David de la Cruz was the virtual red jersey, but then there was a real kind of reshuffle. Movistar's Nelson Oliveira joined up with Grumme at the front with about 20 to go, and then finally they were caught on the climb by Herrada and Dylan Teuns, who then dropped them with a couple of kilometres to go. It was an interesting finish, wasn't it? Because Herrada, who held the red jersey for a couple of days last year, really got an armchair ride to the finish from Teuns, who had his eyes on the red jersey, and that is exactly how it panned out. Herrada took the stage and Teuns took the red jersey. But a really bad day for EF Education First. Another couple of their riders came down in that crash, along with Urán and Carthy. And then, to make matters worse, TJ Van Garderen, who'd been in the break, crashed on a descent. So the Vuelta has lost the riders who were 5th, 6th and 13th overall this morning. Dylan Teuns is the new leader, 38 seconds ahead of De La Cruz. Miguel Angel Lopez is now down in 3rd, but no material difference to his standing overall, unless we think that Teuns or De La Cruz are going to be long-term prospects.
The fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. If you want to vote for this week's Pedaleur de Charme in the Vuelta a España, you can do so on our Twitter feed now, @cycling_podcast. The nominations are Mitch Docker, who took responsibility for the crash that brought down Rigoberto Urán the other day. Sergio Higuita, who pushed Phil Bauhaus up a climb, apparently, according to one of our listeners. Quentin Jaraguay, who gave a young fan in a wheelchair a musette, and Angel Madrazo for being generally charming, but particularly in a press conference the other day. The recipient of the award will get a Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt, with which Richard will award on his arrival at the race this weekend. So do get your votes in overnight on Twitter. Now, Daniel, what did you make of the way the stage panned out, and the fact that we had this situation at the front where Dylan Teuns found himself in the opposite position to the one he was in at the Tour de France, where, of course, he won the stage on La Planche des Belles Filles, riding with Giulio Ciccone of Trek Segafredo that day, who stood to take the yellow jersey. This time, he had his eyes on the race lead and was pretty happy to let Herrada take the stage.
Yeah, Teuns, a couple of years ago, he had a bit of an issue with finishing opportunities. Well, even last year, there were a couple of times in fairly big races when he was in a good position to win, but always found someone who was stronger or faster than him. And this year, he's rectified that, really. Had a lot of success and won the Dauphiné, was the leader of that race for a few days, sort of for a couple of days, surprised himself, I think finished sixth overall. And then he had his excellent result at the Dauphiné. And yeah, he looks like someone who's riding with, well, he's finally located that sort of confidence, that coolness under pressure, which allows people to finish off opportunities like today. I was a bit disappointed the Skarbu Grame, the Ethiopian from Mitchelton Scott, didn't get his win. I've got a real sort of soft spot for him. I met up with him 3 or 4 years ago, and he told me his whole story. He has 10 siblings. They grew up in a two-room house. He used to share a bedroom with three sisters. They all sort of borrowed each other's clothes. He lives in a place called Mekele, or is from a place called Mekele, which weirdly has this has always had quite a big cycling culture in Ethiopia. And it's 2,200 meters above sea level, but it's actually pretty close, about an hour or two's drive from one of the lowest places on earth, the Danakil Desert, the Danakil Depression, which is sort of quite often referred to as one of the least hospitable places on earth, one of the hottest, driest places on earth. And yeah, he's got a really interesting story. Rode his first races on a Marco Pantani replica Bianchi bike. He's a rider who's always got a smile on his face, always an absolute delight to sort of talk to, and someone who, you know, after 5 or 6 years in the pro peloton, really feels as though anything that comes his way now is a bonus, that he's already made a much better life for himself, for his family, and just loves being at races. And so it would have been nice to see him get the stage, and it was a fantastic attack, and he really made Teuns and some really strong riders in that group behind work very hard to catch him, and eventually Nelson Oliveira.
Well, he went early, didn't he? It was a big ask, really, that for any rider. Anyone in that group would have thought twice, perhaps, about going that far out. And they made a really good fist of it. When Oliveira came up, Grame was still giving him Teuns. I mean, there was, you know,
turns.
He was still giving Oliveira Teuns. And then when Teuns came up, well, he had no answer then. He didn't give anyone any Teuns. Certainly didn't give Teuns any Teuns.
What about the other Teuns in the Vuelta? There's another Teuns in the Vuelta, isn't there? Teuns, Teuns.
Edward Teuns, well, he wasn't in the break, Daniel. No. Let's hear from Dylan Teuns, whose name is changing and evolving as the podcast goes on. But he was talking at the finish about his single-minded focus and how he had his eyes on that red jersey from pretty early on. Well, from before the start of the stage, really.
Because after the tour, I came pretty close there. Then I started to realize that it's possible also to get the leader jersey in a Grand Tour, and it was a goal in this Vuelta, and yeah, I did it. Yesterday I was disappointed about not in the break, but I still kept going on the climb to don't lose too much time, and it was all about my plan, actually, yes. With 3K to go, or 4? I knew like a 3-4 minute climb is like my specialty. It's like the Ardennes in Belgium. From then on, I went just full gas with the hope that nobody would stay in the wheel, but there was one guy who could follow, and yeah, he didn't want to pass me to make another turn, so I could recover a bit. I didn't have the punch anymore, so Yeah, I give everything for the jersey today. Also for the victory, but in the end, one guy was smarter or stronger.
He's a good rider, isn't he, Dylan Teuns? And one of the people you would imagine will survive the coming changes at Bahrain Merida when Rod Ellingworth is able to mould the team into something more in line with what he has in mind, I guess.
Yeah, a real old-school rider in the sense that he absolutely lives for his profession. I've seen interviews with him, heard interviews with him where he's talked about the fact that he's never really been able to go out. He's barely ever set foot in a nightclub, and I suppose a bit of a throwback, really, because you often get the sense through things like social media and internet that the young generation or the current generation of pros in the peloton are very, very much connected to their peers, connected to a lifestyle which they can't really afford to lead, and some of them, I think, maybe fight a bit of a battle with that. And I think a lot of them can sort of turn on for a few months of the year. They can be really disciplined, but they do sort of feel pangs of wanting to experience other things, maybe things that their friends at university or who have normal jobs are experiencing. But Dylan Teuns, you get the sense that there's none of that, really. He's someone who just lives for riding his bike, trains very hard, and very much reconciled to that.
And extremely versatile as well. Remember at the start of the year, he was in the winning move at Het Nieuwsblad. Okay, he didn't have an answer for the likes of Stibar, Van Avermaet, Wellens and Lutsenko, who finished ahead of him. But just to be in that group at the start of March or the very end of February, whichever it was, racing over the cobbles in the cold, and then winning at La Planche des Belles-Filles, and then taking the red jersey today. Let's not forget that Jesus Herrada is no slouch, is he? He won on Mont Ventoux in June ahead of Romain Bardet in a race that didn't have a brilliant field, but still, he still had to climb up Mont Ventoux quicker than Romain Bardet.
Yeah, it was interesting speaking to Herrada at the finish. From the outside, people might have thought that today was, you know, a win for the underdog, all the big names in that group. And there were some big names, Robert Hasing, Dylan Teuns, David de la Cruz, people with quite impressive palmares. They might have thought that Herrada was the underdog. But he speaks like a man who feels he very much belongs at the top of professional cycling. He wasn't in any way giddy or in the same way that Madarazzo was yesterday, who, you know, talked about it in terms of it being the result of a lifetime and something that was never going to be repeated. Herrada sort of carries himself like a real team leader, like a real baller.
Teuns got the red jersey, but it could have been David de la Cruz, who almost wasn't going to ride this Vuelta. A very late selection change by Team Ineos, but he faded towards the end. The other notable rider in that break, I thought, was Robert Hesink, who is making his comeback after a really bad crash at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which ruled him out of the Tour de France. And I think he only came back at the Tour of Poland earlier this month. So he's now moved up on GC. I'm not saying that that's strategically going to make an awful lot of difference for Primoz Roglic, because when the attacks first went, Hesink didn't really, didn't really have an answer, did he? He was kind of waiting until later on, and he gained some places, in the last couple of K.
Just on De La Cruz, Napalm, Herrada, Jesus Herrada and his brother have both just renewed their contracts at Cofidis, and I understand that David De La Cruz is going to he's going to boost the Spanish contingent at Cofidis. That's what I heard today, latest rumour. I think it was well known that he came into this world sort of wanting to put himself in the shop window. A mooted move to Movistar having broken down earlier in the summer. But yeah, that was what I heard today anyway, that Cofidis are certainly now the favourites to land David de la Cruz.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the cycling podcast is sponsored by Roca, which was founded in 2013 in a garage in Austin, Texas, with the mission to create the world's finest eyewear. And 6 years and 30 plus patents later, Roca athletes have won numerous world titles, stages of the Tour de France, and until tonight also had the red jersey at the Vuelta a España, because Miguel Angel Lopez wears Roca sunglasses, as does this rider.
Hey, I'm Dan Martin. I'm currently riding for UAE Team Emirates. I first heard about Rocker sunglasses when they were, before they were even for sale. I had the opportunity to select my own sunglasses partner, and I've always had a history of trying to select partners that who help me race faster, you know, help me ride faster, and who offer top quality products. And yeah, obviously when a new sunglasses brand that you've never heard of comes along, I wanted to test them out first. And I remember receiving the package, and the same goes for anybody who I've known who have tried on a set of Rocker sunglasses. I think the first thing that hits you is the quality of the lens and the lightweight. And yeah, that's essentially why I decided to start working with them. And then obviously I got to know the Rocker family, and yeah, it really feels like it's a great fit for me. And yeah, I'm really proud to be supporting the brand.
If you'd like to check out the full range of Rocker sunglasses and see what Dan Martin is so enthusiastic about, go to roker.com/Vuelta. That's roker.com/Vuelta, and Rocker is spelled R-O-K-A. And if you place an order, you can get 20% off your order with that link. We'll talk about the overall race in the final part of the podcast, but before then, let's hear again from our two diarists who... Well, I've said it every night, but they're doing a fantastic job telling us what it's like to be in the peloton. Nick Schultz, his teammate Grimet, was up the road, of course, today. Both he and James Knox reflected on just how hard the opening 50 kilometres or so of the stage were.
Wow-wee. So, as anticipated, that was... an incredibly difficult start to the stage today, even harder than probably most people thought. From the gun, it was full gas. I don't think the breakaway formed until about 50k in. Oh, and it was a big battle. From a team's perspective, we had Scarbu in there, which was really good, and a really great ride by him to actually get into that group. So him and myself were actually the ones looking for those moves, and I put myself into the red zone a little bit too soon on the first climb. I tried to follow Thomas De Gendt a couple of times, and yeah, after that I was pretty fried, so I had to just hide in the wheels, and then Scarbu took over and did an excellent job to infiltrate that group. At the top of the second climb of the day, I think the group was only 40 or 50 strong, and Astana just kept the pace high. So I think there was a bit of panic behind, but everything sort of regrouped amazingly, considering how high the pace was. And the breakaway had another shot at the race. In a situation like that, on a day like today, when we're almost sure there's going to be a breakaway with big numbers going, it never hurts for any team really to have presence in there. So that's why we were a little bit active. We weren't forcing any moves, but we certainly weren't going to complain if we had someone in there, as it just keeps things a little less stressed. But it's certainly not the number one objective of the team on days like today. It just helps things sort of stay calm and relaxed. But otherwise, glad to have that one behind us. Tomorrow's another hard day, but at least we start on the flat. Who knows? Knowing the Vuelta, it'll probably be blowing an absolute hooli, and we'll have crosswinds to deal with on what could be a calm start, but I'm not sure. I haven't seen any forecasts yet, so that's just a bit of speculation. But you never know here. And also, I've been noticing a few of the questions coming through on Twitter. Certainly on another episode, I'll get around to answering a few of those. There's some really good ones coming in. So thanks for that, and chat tomorrow.
Well, that's another day down. Hard one. First climbs, all out. I think there's only 30 guys left. Fortunately, I think it's one of those days where the TV just won't do it justice. I was trying to get in the move, followed some things early on, and then suffered like a dog just to hold the wheels on the climbs at the start. And there was so many moves, so many people going, coming back, going, and then eventually off the descent of the second climb, the move went, and that was it. But I mean, I think there's only 40 guys left in the front, and Astana kept the pace. It looked like they were worried about De La Cruz up the road. And also they were the only team that I think had a full team there at that moment, so they just kept it going hard. Final group on their own never caught us back all day. make the point of how hard it was, and I think it only 100 kilometers into the race did the second group of 80 guys catch back on. So yeah, really one of those days where deceptively hard, but probably tuning in for the old TV coverage didn't look like much of a contest, just the brakes sliding away and the bunch taking it easy behind. But yeah, no, sort of promise you it wasn't that. Big crash as well on one of the descents. I was pretty lucky. It was on a fast left-hander on one of the descents, and I was on the outside, but I sort of saw it coming, looking through the corner, managed to park up early, watch guys ploughing into this big crash on the right-hand side of the road with the barriers and stuff. So yeah, that wasn't very nice, especially seeing some friends on the ground. Hugh Carthy's out of the race, and I was a bit sad to see him go. Always catch up with him in the race. I think he's broken the collarbone, so I mean, I wouldn't speculate, but ice is DS, so still in those hills outside of Valencia. I like to know where I am, actually. I drop a pin in every hotel we stay in. Been doing that now for a couple of years. This is on Google Maps, so I've got a nice little, every time I open up Google Maps, I've got all these pins dropped all around Europe of different places where I've been and raced, stage finishes and hotels and different things like that. So yeah, it's nice sort of feeling like I'm seeing a bit of the world on my bike, even though don't get to appreciate too much, but actually quite nice roads today, all day just up and down. Didn't make for very nice racing, but I'm sure if you're here as a tourist, it'd be good fun. Still playing a funny game as well in the GC. I'm not really sure what my actual ideas are, but I just sort of followed on the last climb, didn't completely sit up, trying to not go all in and kill myself, but it wasn't too bad for most of it. Only the last couple of K got really well, this stepped on the gas, and yeah, it's actually 2 days in a row now that my mum and dad have been stood at the exact point I get dropped. So yesterday it was like a couple of K into the climb, and today it was a K to go. Don't know how they're managing this, standing exactly as I get dropped. Maybe they can stand a little closer to the finish line from now on, if that's how it's going to work. 25th, way out of it, like 6 minutes down, but still really the main ambition is in getting in the break. I think I've got plenty of sliding room now to try and get up the road. Don't think anyone will be too worried about me. Sort of thinking it'd be quite nice, you know, jump up if the right day and got the right legs, get up the road, get in one of those breaks where the bunch doesn't care, and quite a laugh to be jump all the way up on GC like a few guys did today. But yeah, no, actually the plan was to get in that move. Bit disappointed I couldn't get in it. It was just all out. Spent quite a lot of pennies trying to jump in a few things, but and then when it went, it was gone. So I'm here with Stenek and a mate. What did you think today? Did you think you're going to come back after those first couple of climbs?
Oh, at first I was really suffering so hard on the first two climbs. That's one of the days that you wish you will have a good day. And yeah, I was not really sure if you will come back, but it was really a big group. And we were quite well cooperating together. We were always behind like around 1.5 to 2 minutes. I was hoping that we can come back. I think that the first group, the breakaway, was even not that far away, so it could still happen a lot of things. But then after 100k's we get back. But yeah, then the breakaway was already around 1.5 or maybe 2 minutes away.
Yeah. Okay, that's the day.
Well, that was a great line from James Knox there about his parents standing in the exact place that he's got dropped the last couple of days and imploring them to stand near the finish. Maybe they need to get onto Google Maps and check out Mas de la Costa, where the finish is tomorrow, and just get themselves up there. And also James Knox saying that he puts a pin in his Google Maps every hotel, every kind of stage finish, so he's got a record. Something that probably riders from sort of even 10 years ago couldn't have done that, but now there's a technology exists to really build up a digital database of every decent hotel, every stage finish, picking holiday destinations and such like for the rest of his life.
I was talking to someone today about I hope I've not got the wrong rider, because I heard this story a few weeks ago and I'm pretty sure that it's Thomas de Gendt. He has a vast collection of road books of all the races he's done, I think certainly all the grand tours he's done, and he has a great fantastic sort of photographic memory, or and the mental photograph is of road books. And if he feels, he senses that a stage he's about to do and he's about to get into a breakaway in is like something he's done before, then he'll call up his wife back home in Belgium and he'll get her to dig one of the old, well, the relevant road book out of the attic and get her to talk him through the map and the elevation profile. I think it's Thomas De Gendt. If it's not, this is a terrible, terrible faux pas.
If it's not, then it's somebody else, one of the other cyclists.
Another rider does that.
Another rider does that. Well, Thomas De Gendt, something that Thomas De Gendt definitely doesn't do is have a massage after the stages. And the subject of massage and the job of the soigneurs is going to be the subject of tomorrow's Kilometre Zero. So listen out for that. That will be out in the morning. But yeah, odd that, well, certainly in a maybe not unique, but very much in a minority, a tiny minority, doesn't have a massage after any race.
So hang on, you're doing a Kilometre Zero on massage?
Well, no, I did a Kilometre Zero on the job of the soigneurs who happened to do sports massage.
Podcast has really been cheapened since I've not been making regular appearances.
What's cheap about a sports massage?
Okay.
They last for an hour.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. You'd have thought, you know, all the time I've been covering cycling, I'd know that a massage...
What do you mean they last an hour? What do you mean they last an hour? Everyone's massage doesn't last exactly the same amount of time.
45 minutes to an hour.
On average, maybe.
Well, yeah, okay. Oh, blimey. I mean, at least listen to the episode before splitting hairs, Daniel. Anyway, that will be out tomorrow morning, and we'll hear more from Nick Schultz and James Knox tomorrow as well.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport, regular sponsors of the Cycling Podcast for, well, many years now, and we're very grateful for that. If you want to purchase any of the Science in Sport products from scienceinsport.com, you can get 25% off with the code SISCP25. And if you're going to the Science in Sport website, which is scienceinsport.com, you might want to check out the series of videos with Team Ineos riders called Bonking Tales, in which they talk about the dreaded bonk, which is running out of energy due to getting their fueling strategy wrong. You can learn how to fuel smartly by learning from the pros. Have you ever run out of energy dramatically, Daniel?
It used to happen to me a lot, because I never used to eat really on the bike, and certainly never used to drink. I was like Pantani, he was like a camel. Just carried all my water, I don't know where. But bonking, that'd be a good... Well, I'm not...
Hang on, you're having a go at me for talking about a massage.
Bonking would, in all seriousness, and I'm trying to be serious, it would actually be a very good Kilometre Zero. It's something that I think is something that's kind of disappearing from professional cycling.
Well, I think it is because of the... Well, we'll hear from the soigneurs, you know, the way they make up the musettes and make sure that on hot days the nutrition strategies are tailored for the weather conditions. They, you know, they've got so much more information available, and they've got the products which are effectively concentrated, so the riders can consume everything that they need in relatively small quantities of stuff. That's the whole point of these products, isn't it?
Best bonk you can remember from professional cycling or from your own cycling career. I've had some terrible ones.
I do remember the only time we've ever been cycling together, Daniel, you blew up spectacularly and stopped at a little corner shop and emptied the place out of chocolate bars. I remember that.
That was probably the last time I ate chocolate, and that was about 2004.
It was more recently than that, but yeah, you were struggling, weren't you, after sort of 3 or 4 hours?
I don't eat on the bike, but anyway, top bonk, as far as I'm concerned, Cadel Evans in 2002 Giro is probably the most memorable one for me.
Well, there was also Chris Froome's near bonk, wasn't there, in the Tour de France, where he wanted to take a bottle in the last 20 kilometres of the mountain stage, and it was Alpe d'Huez, wasn't it? That's right, and well, he would have taken a time penalty had he done that. So Team Sky, having weighed up all of the circumstances and crunched the numbers, decided that it would be smarter for Richie Port, his teammate, to take the bottle and hand it over, and that meant that Froome avoided a fine. Or did they give him a time penalty anyway? I can't remember. I'd have to check that.
I think he did get a time penalty. It's interesting, you know, we sort of, that gets a bit awkward when we start talking about bonking, but just linguistically, how each language sort of treats that phenomenon of, you know, running out of food, running out of energy on the bike. Frangal in French, crisi di fame, just a hunger crisis, and similar in Spanish.
Well, Daniel, it's 8:15, and knowing that in Spain I can't have dinner until 9:30 at the earliest, I'm in danger of having a fringal or a really difficult bonk.
There was no danger of you bonking last night, was that?
Oh, for heaven's sake.
I'm serious.
No, there wasn't. We had our truffle dinner last night, which was really, really good. And the summer truffles, as you described them, not as woody, I didn't think,
quite
and
subtle.
Not very subtle flavour, really delicate, almost like petals when shaved, where, you know, sometimes even the more common, or certainly the truffles that I've eaten before, the black truffle, even when shaved, they do have a sort of woody quality. But we had a poached egg with some very delicately shaved truffle, didn't we, followed by a cauliflower puree with some truffle, followed by a very, very nicely cooked medallion of pork with some truffle.
And at one point in the meal, I think at the start of the meal, one of these truffles was produced, wasn't it, and put in front of us on the table, and it was quite impressive, wasn't it? It was about the size of a softball, bigger than a cricket ball, wasn't it, black and knobbly.
Very niche reference at a softball.
Or a size 4 football.
Yeah, it was like a small cauliflower, but black. And similar kind of shape, knobbles on it as a cauliflower. Anyway, that's enough. That's enough of the truffles. Overall, we didn't learn a great deal today, did we? Miguel Angel Lopez is out of the red jersey, but might very well be back in it again this time tomorrow. The finish, I said yesterday about today's finish, I was under the impression it had some steep ramps in it, and I got that wrong. It's tomorrow, which is significant. Mas de la Costa. And the race has been there before.
Yeah, I went there 3 years ago, and it's a typically goaty Vuelta climb. By goaty, I mean obscenely steep, and the surface is also a bit dicey. It's one of those kind of concrete roads that's been laid in slabs. I'm not actually sure why the road was made in the first place. Someone told me something interesting today, that there's some kind of like Rastafari commune up there. Last time, the guys, the journalists who went up there last time, you know, they barely made it down. There was so much sort of weed smoke swirling around. I think they enjoyed themselves in ways that they hadn't envisaged. But this really intrigued me because it seems quite incongruous. It's a long way from the coast, or a fair way from the coast. You know, we've seen the last couple of days, Napalm, how remote these areas of Spain are as soon as you go inland. So, I didn't plan to go to the top tomorrow because the team buses are parked to the bottom. We're probably going to do interviews there, but I might change my mind.
So, I mean, bonking, weed smoking, dear me, we're going to have to put some kind of explicit language warning on this podcast.
We haven't even mentioned Superman and the Whalers yet.
Oh, God. Gosh, what a segue. Well, we do know, obviously, that Rigoberto Urán is out. And although he was already a little bit bashed up after his crash a couple of days ago, so we weren't entirely sure how he would go overall, it's shaping up at the moment to be a battle between Miguel Angel López of Astana and Primoz Roglic of Jumbo-Visma. This morning, I grabbed a quick word with Adi Engels, who was their sports director at the Giro d'Italia, of course. And Roglic's challenge in the Giro kind of came undone, didn't it, on the day when he had mechanical problems and had to swap bikes because the team car was nowhere to be seen, because Jan Boven and Adi Engels had stopped to answer the call of nature, and they got a lot of criticism for that. But there's definitely a sense here that the whole team lineup for Jumbo-Visma has got a lot more strength in depth, even taking into account the loss of Steven Kruijswijk earlier on in the race. How did you assess yesterday? Because Sepp Kuss was riding extremely strongly and Primoz Roglic reacted when he had to.
We look back to yesterday, for us it was a really good day in the end. It was a bit of a strange stage, of course, where we expected a big fight for the break. Then the fight wasn't that big, only 3 guys left, and then you expect that in the end it will be closed down. But yeah, there was like a lot of hesitation in the bunch, even at the beginning of the last climb. But then when it started to explode, I think it looked really good for us. Also, Robert Geesink, Nielsen Paulus, even Tony Martin was able to do his part on the climb. And then afterwards, when it really exploded, Primoz was where he had to be. And Sepp was better than expected. I mean, as a support rider, to finish that close was really strong.
After the Giro, where Roglic was so good so early and then just seemed to fade in the last week, this Vuelta is a different way round. The final week isn't quite so hard. It may be more important to be good in the middle.
I think in the Grand Tour you have to be good for 3 weeks. And although maybe I agree with you till a certain moment that I think the hardest part is around the middle, but the last week in the Grand Tour is always hard. And then other things also start to count. So in the end, I think it will never be decided before Madrid. The other difference to the Giro is that before the Giro, of course, Primoz had quite a big campaign. Very successful campaign, of course, till Romandy. So when he started the Giro, he was really top. On the other hand, he also made a big gap in the first part of the Giro. So we can look at that from different angles. It's also not important now. The difference now is that after, more or less after the Giro, he didn't race. He only did the Nationals. And he prepared really well. So I think what he showed now in this first days, after having not having a race for so long, it looks good. It looks promising.
And have you, as a team and sports directors, did you learn anything from the Giro that might help here?
We always learn every day. When you lose, when you win, there's always things you can learn. But it's very difficult now to say, okay, that's the thing. If we change that, then it's different. It's always a lot of things together, you know.
It doesn't work like that. Not just one thing.
No.
So that was Adi Engels playing up the performances of Sepp Kuss, who was exceptional, if I can torture the English language enough to say that. Tony Martin today was pretty bashed up in that crash and had lost the back panels of his shorts, and that looked pretty raw as he came over the line. But it's not been a seamless first week for Jumbo-Visma, but it's been a good first week.
It has, Napalm, and I think it's been pretty obvious to everyone that Sepp Kuss has stepped up since the Giro. I was actually watching the stage of the Tour of Utah last week, and it always, as it always does, it really struck me how different racing in the US is. And it was the Tour of Utah that was really Sepp Kuss's big breakthrough race in the States, wasn't it? Where he was by far the best climber. But the roads that US races generally take place on are so incredibly wide compared to the races the riders see here in Europe that it really takes positioning out of the equation. And, you know, as we see on every vaguely hilly day in the in major tours and major races, there's so much energy expended just in getting the right position and getting your teammates in the right position. And that's something that's probably taken Sepp Kuss a while to deal with. I mean, he certainly looks to have the engine. And so he's been good. George Bennett is very solid and consistent, and I think team leaders can always count on him in the mountains. And they've got Hasink as well. Hasink's experience, he didn't look as though he was on a great day today in that break, but you would think he would be valuable too. So I'm
curious, him being in that break, is that, I've got the sense that this is a chance to kind of ride himself back in and you know, maybe we'll step up a level by putting himself in, you know, basically giving himself a hard day rather than just, not that it was easy in the bunch, as we've heard from both Nick Schultz and James Knox. It sounded like a really hard day right from the off, but just to get up the road and give himself a bit of confidence, having not really been at the pointy end of anything for quite a while now.
Yeah, that could be the case. It was also possibly one of those days when everyone knew a break would go, but no one knew exactly when it would go and who would be in it, and it may be that he found himself up at the front of the race and just seized the opportunity that was there. I suppose you might think, well, you know, why are they sending him up the road when he needs to save energy before, you know, the mountain stages that are coming? But I don't think he'll necessarily have to do too much tomorrow. Certainly the last climb, he's not one where teammates will be terribly useful. And then we've got a relatively flat stage into Catalunya, and then the big stage in Andorra, which is where he certainly will be, I think, key for Primoz Roglic. But that's a very short stage, and it's a few days away.
Well, just before we go, Daniel, what's going to happen tomorrow? Is it going to be a full-on GC battle on that final climb?
I think there'll definitely be some time gap. I think we've seen Nairo Quintana win a stage of the Vuelta Valenciana very convincingly on that same final climb in 2016. There were time gaps, not huge time gaps, but it's steep enough to hurt the GC contenders. And I think that Superman will see it as another opportunity to gain some time. And I was kind of intrigued by Movistar's tactics today. I thought there was an ideal opportunity for them when the gap was holding, when the break had gone, the gap was holding at around 3 minutes. I thought that was the time for them to relieve Astana of some of their pacemaking duties and take the chance to set up Alejandro Valverde on what looked as though it was going to be a perfect finish for him. And because, you know, he's high up on the general classification at the moment, but he's made no qualms about the fact that he doesn't think that he can win the race. He's mainly here to win stages. So I thought there was, you know, they'll rarely get an opportunity that's better than today's.
I wonder whether Valverde thinks that Quintana can win the race as well, because, I mean, he didn't really do anything to help Quintana yesterday, and we'll have to see how it plays out. But certainly they, in kind of level pegging with one another, they've handed the initiative to Lopez and Roglic at this stage. But yeah, long way to go. I mean, you know, yesterday there was me thinking that Lopez was going to be in red all the way to Madrid. I didn't say it, but it looked like one of those moves where just ghosting back into the red jersey, and he'd build from there. But now, well, he's not in it tomorrow, is he? Not that he's going to worry too much about Tunes or De La Cruz, you wouldn't have thought. But who knows? I mean, maybe De La Cruz is going to... he's not going to win a Grand Tour with Cofidis, is he? But he might with Ineos.
Yeah, I can't see him, to be honest, being in the shake-up. And I don't think he thinks he'll be in the top five when we get to Madrid. But I think Napalm, generally speaking, just over the last 24 hours, it's been amazing, yet again, how hasty people have been in drawing conclusions from yesterday's stage and declaring the race almost over. It should be banned. It should be banned. Any speculation about the outcome, I know we've done it, we've indulged in it slightly, but until day 10, it should be banned. We did it at the Giro with Roglic, or people did it at the Giro with Roglic. Alaphilippe, I mean, I told you, didn't I, about the various bets I had with people. I kind of went the other way and went too far the other way. I had all these bets with people that he wasn't even going to finish in the top 10. But there were a lot of people who were convinced that, you know, who were talking after stage 10 as though, well, you know, it was a done deal. And Alaphilippe had never finished in the top 20 in a Grand Tour before, but people thought he had it sewn up. So,
well, I completely agree with you, but I got suckered in a bit yesterday just because I figured that Lopez, well, he's a good enough climber, and he's been on the podium, you know, in two Grand Tours in the same season, which, all right, not, you can't really say that two third places equals one win, but it does feel like his time. And I think he's got more about him on the climbs than Roglic. He's a bit more punchy, a bit more explosive. Roglic has the advantage in the time trial, and I think also just in that sense of, you know, perhaps grinding people down. But Lopez is in a very strong Astana team.
It's all over, isn't it? Superman's got it in the bag, really, if we're honest.
Well, on that note, let's say goodbye for this evening, and let's thank some of our friends of the podcast for supporting us all year round. Your decision to sign up as friends of the podcast is much appreciated. Hopefully we deliver some episodes that you really enjoy as well in exchange for your £15 or maybe more if that's what you would like to contribute. But a big thank you from me to David Edwards, Simon Lockwood, Peter Haykowski, I hope that's right, Benjamin Havel, Mark Wakeling, Kevin Mitz and Chris Reed,
Zandobesk, Paulo de Serpa Pimentel, I guess he's Brazilian or Portuguese, Peter Klusky, Neil Baker, Tom Hooker, Peter Wilson and Robin Perez.
I bet that's Tom Huck. Thank you very much, Tom, whether it's Huck or Hucker. Let us know on Twitter @cycling_podcast. Well, Daniel, Thank you very much. I will see you tomorrow for the third in this kind of trilogy of tricky stages in the Vuelta before a little lull on Saturday.
Yes.